Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. Up first on this week's show, we'll hear two perspectives on the herbicide atrazine. You may never have heard of it, but chances are that atrazine is used on a farm near you. It's one of the most widely used herbicides in the United States, but its application is banned in the European Union because of concerns that the compound could contaminate groundwater and cause cancer and other human health effects. Today on the show, we'll begin with biologist Dr. Tyrone Hayes. He was hired by Syngenta, atrazine's manufacturer, to investigate the herbicide. He's now one of the leading crusaders against the application of atrazine. When we reached out to Syngenta to be part of the story, they declined to be interviewed. We recommended that we speak with someone from the Maryland Farm Bureau. They connected us with Mark Fuchs, owner of New Hope Farm in Denton, Maryland. He uses atrazine on his fields, and he joins us to discuss why taking atrazine off the market would hurt food supplies. We'll round out the show with a conversation with Winona LaDuc, a former vice presidential candidate and noted environmental advocate, for a conversation about wild rice and much more. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Tyrone Hayes, who's a professor of integrative biology at Berkeley in California, who's been working on this issue of atrazine, and we want to welcome to our program Soundbites. Tyrone Hayes, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
So tell us a bit about, well, first let's start with this. Start with, for our listeners, atrazine. It is we know it's a chemical that is commonly used in the corn fields of Maryland, Minnesota, sugarcane fields throughout the South, to help the growth of crops, and there's been a battle over whether or not to pull it. So talk a little bit about what atrazine is.
So atrazine, as you just said, atrazine is a weed killer, an herbicide. It's primarily used on corn. It's also used on sugarcane, as you just indicated. It can be used in some states for lawn care. It's been used in golf courses in some places. And I was introduced to atrazine by the manufacturer, who asked me to study effects that it might have on animals, and in studying animals to also make some predictions about how atrazine might affect humans.
And that means interesting, Sojourn. So you were originally contracted by the company that produces atrazine, is that right?
That is correct. I was originally contracted by the manufacturer to study atrazine. I hadn't heard of atrazine prior to that contact. At the time, they were Novartis. I mean, as you know now, the company's been sort of rearranged. So during the time that I worked with them 10 years ago, they became Syngenta, the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me is that you actually were hired by the company to do an analysis, and your work led you to go, this herbicide atrazine is dangerous.
Yeah, well, what I was asked to do was to look at how atrazine might affect amphibians. And specifically, I was asked to examine whether or not atrazine might act as an endocrine disruptor or something that causes hormone imbalances in amphibians, in frogs. And we discovered that atrazine caused testosterone levels to go down in males, so they were demasculinized or chemically castrated. And the result of that is their larynx or their voice box doesn't develop properly, so they can't attract females, and they also don't develop sperm properly. And in some cases, they make estrogen, the female hormone, and actually are converted into females, to functional females, and hermaphrodite.
So now, of course, the farmers are arguing really strongly against this, as are the organizations, as is Syngenta, the company, that the levels, the parts per billion of atrazine in our waterways or in the animals itself are too small to really affect, not the animals, but in our waterways and the land, are too small to really affect human beings.
Well, I think there are a couple things that need to be clarified in the argument. One is, I don't think, in my interactions, that farmers are really saying that. I think that the organizations and the farming associations that are supported by the manufacturer are making that argument. But in the experience that I've had working in the Midwestern United States, when you talk to farmers, they don't want stuff in their water either. They're as concerned as anybody else. In fact, more concerned because it's their children, et cetera, that are being exposed. And now that we're seeing all these data showing that atrazine is associated with low sperm count in men, that atrazine is associated with breast cancer and prostate disease in women and men, respectively, that atrazine is associated with abortion or miscarriage, atrazine is associated with a number of birth defects, farmers are very concerned. It's just the organizations and associations that are funded by the manufacturer who make those statements. The other thing I would respond to is the levels that we see in farmers and men who apply atrazine can be up to 24,000 times higher than we know to be biologically effective. And one of the mistakes that people make, that the industry actually puts out there intentionally, I think, is if you look at an effect on a rat, you don't scale up because humans are bigger. Bigger animals have much lower metabolism, so you don't have to scale up the amount of atrazine to that huge amount that they're claiming. The fact is, we are exposed at levels that are associated with adverse health effects that we know we can reproduce and support in control studies in the laboratory. So that's really a fallacy.
And what's the state of it now, of our use of atrazine in America and around the country? Because I understand that the company that produces it in Switzerland cannot mm-hmm. sell it in Switzerland, nor they can sell it anywhere in the European Union.
Yeah, the European Union has banned atrazine, or as the company likes to correct me, they've denied regulatory approval for the sale of atrazine in the European Union, which is, of course, interesting because here we're using still 80 million pounds in the United States. It's the number one contaminant of our rainwater, our drinking water, our groundwater, our surface water, you name it. So it's really quite ironic.
Now, in opposition to this, you've been attacked pretty seriously. You were attacked by some in the industry saying that you wouldn't give your data to the EPA. You were accused of sending obscene emails to people as well. I mean, this has been a pretty vociferous attack on you as a person.
It's been a very personal attack, and you might know. 2 weeks ago, the Center for Media and Democracy gained access to written documents from Syngenta. Those were released as a result of a judge's ruling. And those documents show what I've known all along, that the manufacturer spent $30 million over the last 10 years in generating bad PR and personal attacks on me. Those documents have revealed, as is about to be published next week, that they plotted to tie up my finances, try to get me fired from the university. They made personal attacks, and now the rumor is that these were recorded, and now reporters have access to these recordings. But they made personal attacks where they threatened me and my family, and now this is very well documented. And some of those attacks occurred via email, and yes, I responded to some of those email attacks, and some of those were subsequently made public by the manufacturer, I think much to their dismay, because it really raised attention to their behavior and to the dangers of atrazine, both in the scientific community, but also because this stuff ended up in the tabloids, et cetera. It brought attention to people who otherwise wouldn't have even heard of atrazine. You know, for example, there were articles published in hip-hop blogs, about me and my fight against Syngenta. So it really actually worked to their disadvantage.
And it seems in some ways, not to throw this into it, but what you just said and what I've been reading and the way your emails were portrayed and what you just said in terms of the hip-hop world, part of it is felt like race.
Oh, yeah.
As an African-American man, a biologist, a scientist, that these attacks were coming in a pretty vociferous way that included those kind of attacks, I think.
Yeah, well, I think what happened, and I made a joke about this once, and now we know for sure it's a reality. I think what happened is, if you think about who's been on the forefront for environmentalism, and especially in terms of pesticides, et cetera, right? It's been most recently Theo Kolbarn. It's been Sandra Steingraber. It's been, Rachel Carson. And I think what happened is, they generate these PR teams, And most of their opponents now have been white women, which, you know, you make a certain, you know, you develop a strategy and how you're going to intimidate, and now all of a sudden they got this black guy from South Carolina. You know, they made a joke once that they were probably sitting around Googling things that upset black people, and literally we now know from these released documents that's what they did. They hired a PR firm who literally instructed them on things to say to upset me before I was giving a talk. So, for example, in one before one talk in Illinois, Tim Pastor and Syngenta sat down next to me and said, you know, I tell you what, next time you give a talk, I'm going to have some of my good old boys come. You know, and that's a phrase that as a black man, you know, that generates images of, you know, good old boys, of lynching and this kind of thing. And so they literally were instructed on, here's the kind of things that will get to them. You know, so, for example, making jokes about my wife and you know, they'll have, you know, relationships that they have with my wife, supposedly, and things like that. You know, those really vulgar, you know, kinds of things that I think exactly right. Some of it was race-motivated, race-based.
What about the articles in places like Atrazine News that kind of attack the science of reproductibility and missing data and not giving data to the EPA that the work you've done cannot be verified by other scientists? That's been part of the attack from the industry as I've been reading
it. Well, I mean, there's several things there. One is this business about not giving to the EPA is a completely fallacious statement. I worked extensively with the EPA. They spent time in my lab. They got access. I have emails from the EPA thanking me for providing my raw data and providing access to all of my information. What they've done now is in my most recent work said Hayes refused to share his data with the EPA. Well, the EPA never asked me for any data. That's like saying Hayes refused to share his data with the FBI. Well, if the FBI asked, they could have access. In fact, I cannot refuse to give data to the EPA. I'm at a public university. Right, and even if I didn't want to, if they filed a FOIA, I would have to give them the data. And so the EPA, it's never happened. I mean, but if you're somebody in the public and you hear, oh, Hayes refused to share his data, you think, well, there's something wrong. That's just simply it's not even a lie. It's just a fallacious, made-up statement. With regards to me being the only scientist and irreproducibility, again, it's just a fallacious statement. I just published a paper with a dozen authors from around the world showing the same kinds of effects in atrazine and everything from fish to amphibians to reptiles, birds and mammals. And I have another paper coming out with 50 co-authors from around the world, 15 different countries, all of us independently showing that atrazine has negative effects. The only people in the world who suggest atrazine doesn't have adverse effects are all on Syngenta's payroll, the manufacturer's payroll. And what these documents that were just published by Center for Media and Democracy show is that some of these papers weren't even written by real scientists. They were written by people at Syngenta, and then they paid up to $86,000, for example, for one paper for a guy to put his name on it. He didn't even write it. And that's all clear now in the emails and in the documents that were released by a judge in the last few months from Syngenta.
So coming back again to atrazine, and what can be extrapolated out from the research you've done on the endocrine changes in frogs and what's happened to the sex of frogs and how does that translate into what could be potentially happening to human beings who consume water, to the workers who work in the fields?
Okay, we can extrapolate, and then I could tell you what the real data are that are available. You know, one of the reasons that I study frogs simply because they're a good indicator of what's going on in the environment. They, when they're developing, they don't have a placenta, they don't have eggshells, they don't have a protective, impermeable skin. So anything in the environment can get into these animals and affect them. So they may be more sensitive than other animal models that you might look at. But the hormones that are affected in frogs are identical in how they're synthesized and how they work in frogs to humans. They're identical. So if you get something that, like the case of atrazine, is inducing estrogen in frogs, the endpoint might be different, but you can very well be sure that it's going to induce the same types of effects in humans. So in frogs, the excess estrogen causes, for example, males to grow eggs in their testes. In humans, excess estrogen is associated with breast cancer. In frogs, the lack of testosterone, depletion of testosterone, is associated with low sperm count and low reproductive behavior. In humans and other animals, same thing. So what we've done, in addition to looking at frogs, is we've looked at human cell lines, human cancer cells. And we and others, right, there's a group in France that's done what I'm about to tell you. There's a group in the Netherlands that have done what I'm about to tell you. There's a group in San Francisco. There's another group in the U.S. There's another group in Japan. What several of us have shown is that if you put atrazine on a human cell, it starts to make estrogen just like a frog does. What's more is if you put atrazine on a human breast cancer cell, it starts to make estrogen just like frogs do. And as you know, I'm sure, breast cancer is estrogen dependent. So that's bad news, that you have a chemical that's getting into people's bodies that's inducing a hormone that promotes breast cancer. And it turns out one of the things that's upset the company is I've been one of the ones, I believe I was the first to point out, that they also, Novartis, make a chemical that blocks estrogen production to treat breast cancer. So the same company that for, you know, since 1958 has been making a chemical that induces estrogen production and it causes breast cancer in rats, associated with breast cancer in humans, that same company is turning around and selling a chemical that does exactly the opposite to treat the very disease that they're likely promoting.
So when they argue that the parts per billion are too small to affect human beings, let's go back to that. We talked about that a little earlier. That would be one of the arguments why this is not dangerous, and that the EPA really hasn't leaped on this at all, and the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, some place where you've seen huge amounts of parts per billion of atrazine in some waterways, but other ways it's smaller, and that this may affect amphibians, given the biology of amphibian. But how does that affect human beings?
Yeah, I mean, and I would argue that human beings aren't the only concern. First would be my first argument, that amphibians and fish, which are affected at these low levels, are important indicators in the environment, and fish are, frogs are in some places, but fish are incredibly commercially important and important to the economy, especially in countries that rely heavily on fish production. So as you're affecting fish, it will have an indirect impact on us as well. But what's more is the statement itself is fallacious, because we know that atrazine, when you put it on cell lines, is active at levels that are similar in these cells that we know them to be active in amphibians. What's more is we know that factory workers, we know that farm workers are urinating out levels of atrazine that are 24,000 times higher than are active in frogs. And the other thing that's misleading and fallacious about that statement is that 0.1 parts per billion, where we see effects, that's not low. Because you know what levels estrogen are active at?
No.
Estrogens are active at levels that are 1,000 times lower than that. Okay? So we're actually talking about levels, the actual hormone estrogen that we're talking about. For atrazine, we're talking about levels that are 1,000 times higher than we know estrogen to be active. In fact, one of their own scientists, a guy named Klaus Werner, just showed that estrogen is active in frogs at levels that we can't even measure. Okay? So the same thing goes for atrazine. It's probably active in animals at levels that we can't even measure. Our biology, our cells, are much more sensitive than the instruments that we have now to measure these very compounds.
So, and where are we now in this battle over the use of atrazine in our fields, which the arguments, of course, are over whether or not it really does increase yields of sugarcane, increase yields of corn, or if it doesn't. That's part of the argument being made, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right? And where are we with all that and with the battles over legislation and atrazine in the United States of America?
Well, I think one of the things that's, that's important, too, is some estimates for corn suggest that atrazine only increases corn yield by 1.2%. You also have to keep in mind that atrazine and corn is it's mostly used on corn. Corn's our number one crop. We eat less than 2% of the corn that we grow. So this idea of, you know, how it's affecting our food availability, et cetera, you know, again, let me repeat those numbers. It may increase corn yield, atrazine, by only 1.2%, a crop that we eat directly less than 2% of, in a world where 20% of our population dies because they don't have access to grains, they don't have access to food. Okay, so you got to weigh what those benefits are against the potential harm, not potential, but the realized harm that we're causing to environmental health and public health. What's happened is that I've helped, I believe, if I give myself credit for anything, I've helped make the science available to legislators. I've helped make that science accessible to legislators. I've helped make that science available to activists. I've helped make the science available to lawyers. I've helped, I believe, help make that science available to the agencies that would regulate atrazine. So what they're under pressure from right now, and the reason that I'm the subject of so much more intensive attacks these days, is they're being faced with a huge lawsuit with water companies suing the manufacturer to get this stuff out of the water so that their customers aren't affected by contaminated water. They're now faced with legislation in places like Maryland, Tasmania, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and hopefully other places, to both locally and on a federal level. Congressman Keith Ellison in the U.S. Congress has written a bill to ban atrazine that's being reintroduced. They're faced now with that as well, and they're faced with potential regulation because the EPA has taken a more careful look. They're faced now with the reality that more and more scientists are becoming aware of the effects of atrazine and talking about the effects of atrazine in a very real way. As I said before, where they've tried to isolate me as a scientist, a dozen of us have already published a paper, and there are 51 of us from 15 countries who've now put all of our data together to present that to the scientific community. That, you know, it's more than just a political issue. There's real science underlying the concerns.
That was Dr. Tyrone Hayes. Up next, here's Mark Fuchs, owner of New Hope Farm in Denton, Maryland. So, Mark, talk about your farm first. Tell us about what you grow and how big your place is.
The home farm's about a 300-acre parcel with about 250 irrigated acres. They typically produce corn, soybeans, wheat, and do a number of acres of both grass hay and alfalfa, horse grass hay for the horse industry.
So yeah, so you grow some for the industry who makes animal feed and I guess for cornmeal or whatever else, and the rest is for the horse industry.
That's correct.
So one of the big controversies that erupted last year, and then we talked about this year in the state legislature, but it really didn't come to the fore as much, though it was debated, was the use of atrazine, which some people in the state of Maryland and around the country, but in the state of Maryland, wanted to have banned. And talk about that from your perspective and how you view that. And let's just talk about how you use it on your farm, if you do.
Well, the atrazine is used almost exclusively, but primarily on the corn production. It's extremely safe, well-established, and quite economical, primarily broadleaf wheat control in corn.
Now, some people, some studies have said that about atrazine and its use, and I'd like to hear what you think about this, that the argument is that atrazine, before we get into the arguments about whether it's healthy or not healthy, that is the yield big or little? Some people I've read in an article said the increase in corn yield is as little as like 1.2%. And that with those who have stopped using it, it hasn't affected their yield at much at all. What are your thoughts on that?
A couple of keys there. Number one, there are other products that can be used, and the challenge is that they're, in a lot of cases, twice as expensive on a per acre basis. So even without an effect on yield, the effect is on the bottom line.
So, I mean, what would be the other things you could use besides atrazine?
There's several broadleaf products post-emergent. So you have to come back into the crop and sometimes multiple trips because you don't have the residual effect that the atrazine gives. Callisto would be one of the newer products on the market. There's a couple others coming on the market here in the next couple of years from the Bayer company.
Some people argue that the yield that you get from atrazine, we talked about it a minute ago, the growth in the yield of, say, in corn, or it's really used more in this country in sugarcane, but in corn as well, doesn't justify its use, given some scientific arguments that it affects endocrine glands, it affects hormonal growth, it changes... It creates, that we can talk about in a little bit, some people are arguing that hermaphroditic amphibians, that this is not, we should be using something else. It just, if we're that worried about the safety of it.
Well, you said it. I mean, there are those that make the statement. The fact of the matter is there is no more scientifically tested and analyzed chemistry that we use than atrazine. It has gone through that entire battery of re-registration, you know, because it has been around 25, 30 years. You know, there's just no, it's pretty indisputable that those kinds of statements, as far as endocrine gland disruptors or the amphibians, have all been validated not to be the case.
Well, I guess that's where the scientists that from the other side would say that we've spoken with would have said that that is the case, that it's been banned by the European Union, that even in Switzerland, where it's the name of the company, Synergeta, the company that makes it, they won't even allow it to be used in the country where it's made. So the controversy does exist. I guess the question that comes down to the line of which side of the line you fall down on the controversy.
Well, certainly, but believe me, the intensity and the volume of data and review process that our EPA goes through, we can move forward with a great deal of confidence that there isn't a negative impact on human health or even wildlife.
You know, I don't know if this, you know, it's the EPA and government agencies. I guess sometimes it depends on which side you look at. I mean, we've seen people in agriculture kind of condemn the EPA because they are overzealous when it comes to certain things in chicken feed, overzealous when it comes to certain things they do with the bay and with farming on the Eastern Shore or anywhere else in America. But on this end, the people argue what the EPA says is helps support the idea of using atrazine. And it's always interesting to me that you know, whatever side it is, once you use the EPA, in other instances, kind of condemn them for not doing the right thing.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, you know, EPA is more than just the, you know, evaluating chemistries and that process. You know, they got their fingers in a whole lot of things. So, you know, there's plenty that the EPA does that I wouldn't hang my hat on, but believe me, the intensity of the process for chemical registration is very intense, and that group of scientists
that what,
and been
sorry.
There and in that process and position, you know, for quite some time. We have the other water quality groups and others that are more political based, I guess, would be a nice way to say.
It would be a nice way to say. Let me come back to that in a second. But what would happen if you didn't use this Syngenta product, this atrazine? What would happen if you did not use it, do you think, on your fields, on your corn? How would it change the nature of your business and what your yield would be, do you think?
Well, the number one thing is that with the genetically modified crops that we have today, i.e. glyphosate resistance, we could come in and use that. The challenge and the opportunity with that system is that continual use, we've demonstrated you build up a tolerant population. You know, you don't change the weeds genetically, but there's always some guy out there that, you know, tolerates that chemistry more than the other, and selectively you increase that population by continual use. So the fact that we have multiple modes of action to protect against herbicide resistance is a key element for long-term sustainability. The other side of it is the cost factor. Atrazine use rate is something around $6 an acre. You'll go to other chemistries. Callisto was one I mentioned earlier. It's about $14 an acre. So yield difference, it can be more challenging because of the timing aspects where you're coming back into the sustaining crop and overspring, where with the atrazine, you're putting it on at planting for the residual effect that it gives.
What do you think would happen if, let's say for argument's sake, it was banned? How would that affect your corn production?
It's going to make me go across the field with multiple trips of herbicide, which each trip costs money. The chemistry that I'm going to replace atrazine with is more expensive, so it's going to cost money. So if my yields are exactly the same, I'm still suffer profitability-wise because I've spent more money to get the same thing.
We're going back to what you were talking about earlier with the EPA. One of the things that one of the articles I was reading just preparing you for this kind of, for I can understand some of this stuff a little bit better, was that I think it was the New York Times had an article saying the EPA officials had met with Syngenta representatives like about 40 times, and that half the studies were led by scientists who at one time either worked for Syngenta or were somehow involved with them. Does that taint it at all for you?
Well, it certainly raises questions, but you got to keep in mind that if you're a specialist working in that type of chemistry, you're going to be familiar with it. So I want the brightest and best guys doing the work.
One of the studies was saying that both the U.S. and Europe showed that atrazine can travel as much as 600 miles from the point of application. You chuckled at that. You think that's not true?
Well, and again, you know, I would challenge the scientific authenticity of a molecule being traced 600 miles. Again, you're talking parts per billion. You know, if I sprayed a cream field in Denton and somebody sprayed one, you know, somewhere in the Midwest.
Right.
Which molecule was it that somebody said moved 600 miles, and how would you ever document that?
I have no idea. I'm just reading. but one of the things that one of the things I have read, though, is that atrazine, you know, in France they've banned atrazine. It hasn't been used for 15 years on corn and any other products in France. They were banned, but they still.
And France has a major successful commercial agricultural industry thriving because of that, right?
Well, they do have an agricultural industry. They've also have they're saying they're finding atrazine in the groundwater still after 15 years.
Yeah. I don't have any way to dispute that, but, does it affect anybody, I guess, is the other side of the question, and that's the bottom line.
So are there any questions that you would have about its use? I mean, when these arguments come up, I mean, sometimes you can talk to scientists on the other side, people who advocate the end of atrazine, and you can push them on the arguments over what other scientists say about it being safe and they were blowing this up because it's so many small parts per billion. But when you see the tests around frogs and changing sex, and some people arguing that it can affect women who are pregnant and fetuses, does that give you pause there at all?
Not when I know the vast years and data that contradicts that. It is the most studied and restudied and documented product that we have in our arsenal of weed control tools as farmers in the United States.
Now, what about how long has your farm been in your family?
My parents moved to the farm right in 1931.
So I'm curious about the history of that on your farm, or the history of your friends and their farms, because most of the men and women I've talked to on the farm have been there for, as you, two, three, sometimes four or five generations on the same land, or at least in the same community. And how different was it for the farmers who grew corn or any other crop? I mean, I know the Eastern Shore was mostly was strawberries and stuff in the 30s and 40s and other things like that and dairy. But how was their crop yield and effect different than it is for farmers in this century using atrazine when they weren't even using that stuff?
I'll give you a very personal example.
Go ahead.
I can remember as a little boy with our hired man spending the vast number of days of the summer with a hoe in a cornfield. Because early on, we didn't have patches. Yes, you know, the very first years that my parents were on the farm, it was horses and mules that they cultivated out the wheat. And then along comes, I guess, originally 2,4-D, and that made a dramatic change. And you cultivated less, and of course, mechanization, the tractors and the bigger tractors and the wider cultivators, you would move across more acres. But very dramatic when atrazine arrived on the scene, and that weed control was so enhanced that instead of doing 10 acres of corn or 20 acres of corn, you could do 50 or 100 or 100 and 100.
Mm-hmm.
So the efficiency and productivity of the American farmer over those from that generation, my parents' generation, to ours, is almost mind-boggling. And with less than 2% of the population actually involved in agriculture producing all the food that the rest of that everybody else consumes,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't be able to do that if we didn't have products like atrazine.
Yeah, because agriculture has changed, I mean, radically since your parents or grandparents work the land. I mean, the way you sell your stuff, you would sell most of your product, whatever you grow, except I guess for the horse industry. I don't know how that industry works, but the other industries, I mean, you sell to larger companies who then turn that whatever you grow, soy, corn, into feed and other things like that, correct?
Certainly.
Right?
Well, the wheat goes to the flour mills in Pennsylvania primarily, but, you know, we get some of those back as tasty cakes or other pastries from the Pennsylvania flour mill. But other than that, probably all the corn, soybeans we produce go to the poultry industry here on the Belmont.
Right, and that has changed everything radically. That shift in the 40s to poultry and in soy and corn changed the nature of industry. The farms are very different. I mean, the nature of farming is different.
Indeed.
So I know that there are advocates who want to bring up the idea of banning atrazine again, that because of its increased use and people feel that it's dangerous. Some people feel it's dangerous. That coming back to your own community. I mean, again, I asked this earlier a little bit about if it didn't exist, if you didn't have those kind of herbicides to grow to put on your fields. It would change the nature of farming. You may have to do a different kind of farming.
Yeah.
Right?
People would get hungry.
Say that again, Mark. What'd you say?
People would get hungry if we didn't have the chemistries that we have today. You wouldn't be able to have the sustainable growth in populations around the world. You know, you think of, you know, there's a lot of folks that say that we're going to have another doubling by the time we get to 2050 of the world's population. And we want to go backwards in our production technology. No, that's not sustainable.
Well, Fuchs, this has been interesting. I look forward to one day meeting you in person.
Well, I'd love to.
Mark Fuchs owns the New Hope Farm in Denton, Maryland. And thank you so much for taking your time with us today.
I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva. Don't go away, because we'll be right back after this very brief break. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. We're going to wrap up today's show with a conversation with former vice presidential candidate and noted environmental advocate Winona LaDuke. Wild rice, the only grain indigenous to North America, has played a major role in her work. And I started our conversation by asking her to tell me about the significance of wild rice.
Monoman, that's what we call it. It means kind Monoma. Of Monoman. It means like wondrous or spirit food, spirit grain, you know. And it's the only grain indigenous to North America.
The
wheat, all those guys come from someplace else. This is it. It's a grass. And it grows on lakes and rivers, and it was a lot more dominant in the northern ecosystems, but with the advent of bad agricultural planning and draining of such things and water diversion projects, we lost a lot of it. But yes, it's very significant in our community. Our people, the Anishinaabeg started out here on the East Coast. We were instructed by our prophets to follow a shell which appeared in the sky to the place where the food grows on the water. And so that is the significance. It's part of our migration story and our most spiritual food, arguably. And
it's central story to everything.
It is. Wild rice is the first food a baby has, and it is also the last food, usually. And it is served at our feasts and our ceremonies. And you're right. I am actually here because of wild rice.
Right.
My father is from the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, as you may gather, since that's where I live. And he, interesting man, he passed away a number of years ago. But
White Bear, right?
Sun Bear. Yeah, Vincent LaDuke.
Right.
And he left the reservation kind of, I'm not going to say to seek his fortune, but to go off. And he hitchhiked across the country. I was looking at some old pictures of the guy. He had like a full-on headdress and a sign that said, "Have blanket, we'll travel." He hitchhiked across the country to New York City with wild rice, and he became a fine purveyor of wild rice, at which point he met my mother, who is a first-generation Russian Jew and is an artist. And she's still an amazing artist. Her name's Betty LaDuke, and she had just come back from mural painting in Mexico for about 3 years and was living in New York again and painting. And he met my mother, and they hit it off quite well, as you can see I'm here.
Here you are.
But he was selling wild rice. And she's like, "What is this?" You know. And then they ran off, and he became an extra in the Westerns. And I was born in East L.A., raised in a small town in Southern Oregon, and then moved home after.
In Ashland, right?
In Ashland, that is right. And then I moved home to my reservation after I graduated from college in 1981.
Not just any college, but Harvard.
Right. When I graduated from Harvard in 1981, I returned and have lived there since. That's about, we'll go 30 years.
One of the things that...
Wild rice.
And so, but one of the things that also hit me about wild rice and your life and the res that you live on is that it's also the story of biodiversity, industrialization, the destruction of wild rice, and you and other people's battle to reclaim it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm going to say I took it for granted that there will always be wild rice. And then I got this knock on the head one day from the University of Minnesota, which was trying to genetically, it cracked the DNA sequence of wild rice, and they wanted the right to genetically engineer it. And, you know, I have some knowledge of these issues, and I was like, well, that makes no sense. The word wild rice should not be associated with the words genetic engineering, and it's no longer wild, you know. And so I got this, like, wake-up call. Around 2001, some of my elders, they knock on my door. They said, "Winona, we got to go take a look at this, you know. And they know I'm a good talker, and I can go down there, and I'm not afraid, pretty much, you know. And plus, I got bigger cousins that are scarier than me, way scarier." So I was like, you know, well, go, let's go. And so began, you know, about a 7-year battle with the U on their right to genetically engineer wild rice. And, you know, which they talk a lot about academic freedom, as do most universities, but there should be an equal amount of academic responsibility. And, you know, that is not right. You cannot genetically engineer something because you will release it into the wild. And yet, you know, you get 60,000 acres of lakes and rivers full of rice and it get contaminated. So I went back and forth with their studies, and they, you know, I call it little ladying you. You go sit there in a meeting, and they would act as if they spoke louder or said it more simply, that I would change my opinion, you know, or that somehow I would evolve and that genetically engineered foods would become acceptable to me, You know, and that whole idea is not only arrogant, it's kind of baffling that someone would not have the common sense to realize that they may not actually be right. You may not actually agree with them. You know, and so we went back and forth, and they talked about their studies on wind drift and pollination. And I said, you know, at one point I said to Musk Plant at the university as a dean, the agriculture school, I said, what about the ducks? Where's your study on ducks? That's who moves rice, is ducks. You know, you're going to control all the ducks and the geese. What's your plan on that? You know, and they looked at me like some poor lost soul. But in the end, you know, we do not have any genetically engineered wild rice. We have the ewe still thinking about things, but I think, you know, we'll see how it goes. I'm pretty confident that it will not work out.
One of the things you said once, in one place you either spoke that you wrote about was that...
How do you know all this about me?
No. I read a lot.
Okay, all right. What did I say?
And I've read your books as well.
Oh, so. Really? Okay, so tell me what I said someplace.
You said it had to do with the what happened in Ireland and with the monoculture destroying the people and the potato that actually came from you in the first place,
yeah.
From native people in Ireland. But that, what did they eat before that? I can't quite figure out, but they had these potatoes.
We gave them the potatoes. The indigenous people.
We gave them the potatoes. Yeah. But you talk about the wide variety of wild rice, and how that you have to really be this guy. What's his name that you wrote about? Spud Finley? Spud Finley. That's Finley. Who goes out?
He's still in this world. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so, but it's the huge diversity of wild rice that is all part of what seems to be the work you've been doing in trying to bring the res and other people back to the foods that were eaten historically,
mm-hmm.
that battle you're making.
Yeah, I mean, our community is actually, you know, in the spectrum of where things are at, we're not in that bad of shape. We have a very strong subsistence economy. There's a push, you know, that is to say, right now we're planning for our gardens, and subsistence may not be, I don't like the term subsistence. We have a land-based economy that is healthy, that is indigenous. In that, you know, right now we're planning for our gardens. People are going out to start picking medicinal plants here, mushrooms. The berries come in. Our moon in June is called O'Day Minigeezus, strawberry moon. Then Mean Geezus, that's our blueberry moon, comes
out. Geezus means moon?
Yeah, yeah. And that mean word, min, is the seed, which is the same thing as monomin or wild rice. It's the same. And mandamin is corn. That min is at the end, just for your little Ojibwe lesson. But it's in there. And then we have, you know, I suppose about middle of May, first 2 weeks of June, we got fiddlehead ferns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, high-end things you get, you know, if you go Whole Foods. I don't know if you know what I'm saying. We have that. You know, and so we have this wealth of an economy. Plus, right now, they're spearing fish. You know, and so... We still have a lot of those foods, but what happens is colonization process, where people are, where the laws make it illegal to harvest, private property signs go up, people start putting pesticides out, you know, pesticide drift. These kind of things have an effect on us. Then there's this lack of recognition for who we are and our way of life. You know, it's obviously been a point of contention for many years that we shouldn't be able to do this. And even with wild rice, the idea that we should have such a great harvest really upset the University of Minnesota. You know, they had to go domesticate things. So, you know, having said that, we have that. But what happens is that this process, and then now increasingly the push in of the cash economy, where people become increasingly addicted to the need for cash, those issues affect us. So a lot of the work we're trying to do is to figure out how to diminish the need for cash, mm-hmm. whether it's through fuel poverty, addressing those issues, or externalizing your food economy so that people can restore this local food way of life and this way of life and be healthy. That's kind of our integrated approach. I don't know if you're following me on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the piece we're after, and we got a good place to start from. We aren't scratching. You know, we are wealthy. You know, I could be busy all the time with this, you know, and I am pretty busy with it. I like it, though. You know, it's good. And my grandkids, I have grandkids now, and they putz around with me. And
Another good Ojibwe word.
Putz, that's right, putz. So I schlep my schmatas too. Do you like that? I thought you liked that, yeah.
So, it's going to be...
My Yiddish is not as good as my Anishinaabe,
though. Ojibwe. I like it. It's a very good mix. But it's also that there's this wealth of thousands of years of seeds and plants and food that you and others are reclaiming around the country, that you're saying we're going to find a way that what we grew before, and it's going to happen again.
And it has broader implications. I mean, you mentioned the Irish potato famine, the creation of a monoculture, agricultural monoculture. I mean, it's widespread in this country, and you've got an unsustainable food system. Of a bunch of monocrops that they now want to genetically engineer because they got one, pest after another because everything's becoming resistant and their topsoil is diminishing and it's all, everything's ending up at the bottom of the Mississippi in the Delta,
right?
So that is really not a long-term plan.
Right.
And that's 50 years of really bad ideas. The question and the answer is not, the scientific paradigm would say that the answer is to continue down that trajectory. What we would say is that there's this other path, which is this green path, which is you discard the bad ideas. You keep a few good things in there, like I like the solar panels, and you got some of them Amish tools, a few other fabulous things. You keep those things, and you probably have to keep a few other things. And then you go back and you restore biodiversity and agrobiodiversity, because that's your answer. If you want to talk about resilience from pesticides, or resilience from pests, if they're called pests or insects, whatever they're called, sometimes they just need a share of the food too.
Exactly.
You got to just own up that you don't get everything, right? But if you have the diversity, then you have a better shot at it. And that's the wisdom, and that also keeps your soil, that rotation, all of that. So, what we're looking at doing, we're going to restore these really old varieties of corn. I have this really cool squash I'm going to talk about later today. 800-year-old seeds.
Oh, I read about this.
Right,
yes.
Right. And I ate some 2 days ago. I served it for the Passover dinner at our house.
Ah, great.
Did you like that? Yeah.
I like that.
We're holiday opportunists in our family.
Yeah.
That's what my kids say. I say. We do. Passover, Easter. The 4th of July I'm not big on. Just have to admit that. But I like blowing up stuff.
Right.
My kids do. But anyway, 800-year-old squash, very good. And those guys are climate change resilient. They were adapted for microclimates for the soil. They're tough guys. But, you have to be mindful with them. You don't just throw your seeds out. You talk to them and it's a little bit of mindful practice. But that's this whole restoration of who we are and how we become better people. Because if you have to be related to your food, mm-hmm. and or related to the earth, and that process of gardening and harvesting and growing and is part of how we do that and become better humans.
Part of what I've heard you say before is when you kind of reflect on what you just said is that you have this philosophy of how we have to decolonize ourselves.
Yeah, I was raised well. People always say we were raised on a lot of traditional foods, but that also we everything from scratch. And that comes from both sides of my family. Nobody, it was like nobody was on the buying boxed foods program, And so, that's my frame of reference. I don't have a frame of reference besides that. But that process of colonization, in the Native community was one where you ended up with commodity foods from the USDA. And then you ended up, if you wanted to be like white people, you ate their food. Really. And so people would say, it makes me feel poor when I eat deer meat. I heard a young woman say that to me. I don't like feeling poor. I feel poor when I eat deer meat.
Rather than fried red, which is...
Right, which is there. That's a perfect example.
Right.
But that's an American thing, too, is that, Americans now eat out, and they eat at McDonald's, and the idea we're too busy to garden, I can't garden, I can't cook, that's all a bunch of marketing that happened after World War II. To get women, to build an agricultural system that, an industrial food system. And so we became dependent, all of us. And now we are entirely dependent, almost entirely dependent. And it is looked at like you're like a back to the land, or there's this whole like marginalization that occurs of people who garden or people who grow their own food or harvest it, instead of, figuring out that what we really need to do is to restore that.
Well, we'll do. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Winona LaDuke and our other two guests, Dr. Tyrone Hayes and Mark Fuchs, for joining us today. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.